Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Well, good evening, everyone. This is Terry Dodd, and you are with Walls in Our Minds. Red, are you on with us? Well, while we're waiting for Red Beckman to join us on the call, and I believe, Al, you're with us now?
Yeah, if you can hear me. Can you hear me all right?
I hear you loud and clear. Boy, what a great radio voice you have, Al.
Thank you.
Al, before I introduce you or have Red introduce you, we always like to open with a prayer, so I'm going to do that.
Okay.
Great, gracious Father, we just are so thankful for all the ways that you've blessed us, and we lift you up as the one and only true God. And we acknowledge the spiritual battles that we are fighting today, especially in our country and even against those who are against you that are running this country in the shadows. And Father God, we pray for protection for all of those that are in Christ. And we ask you to be with us this night and your spirit to go before us in everything we do and say, that we might bring forth truth and that what we say will be in your will. And we pray for our country. And I'm just thankful that you've given me the honor and privilege of working with Red Beckman for these couple of years. And we're very thankful for Aladesk tonight, and I know that he is yours, and we're thankful for that. We just pray that the truth be heard by our listeners tonight, and we pray this in the name of Yeshua. Amen. Well, Red, are you on with us yet?
Yes, I'm on.
Hello, Red. Well, Al,
well, Red.
Al is... That was Al saying hello, Red.
Very good.
Red, would you give Mr. Adask a good introduction?
Well, I don't know if I can give him a good introduction, but I'll tell everybody out there that Al is a tried and true patriot, and he's been at it quite a long time. He's done a great deal of heavy hitting. He took on some big ones in his career, and of course he doesn't like lawyers, and so anybody that doesn't like lawyers, he's my friend. And he used to put out a publication called Anti-Shyster, and it was a great piece of work, and the internet more or less put the printing business or something like that out of business. And so that is not, the Anti-Shyster is not with us anymore, but I guess he's got a site on the internet or something going, I'm sure. He's not standing still. He's got his head down and taking on whatever gets in his way. So, I sure am glad that we were able to get Al on. Anybody that watched 60 Minutes last Sunday seen Al as 60 Minutes tried to make him sound like be a terrorist or something else. And I'm sure I didn't get to see it, but I'm sure he conducted himself very well. So it's all yours, Terry. You can start the show.
Well, Al, I'm going to turn the floor over to you and give you an opportunity to just open it up and I don't know if you want to share a little bit about how you came to being on 60 Minutes and what happened with that. I know that we've got a lot of other things that you consider important that I know that Red and I agree with and want to really have a good discussion on. But I'm just going to turn the floor to you and let you say what you want to open it.
Give you a little background. I started up in 1983 with a divorce. I lost custody of my children, suffered what I regarded as the great injustice of all time. And in fact, at the time, I was thinking I was going to contact 60 Minutes, because when they heard what a railroading I got, they would absolutely want to do the story. Over time, I came to understand that the railroading I got was pretty much like everybody else's. There was nothing exceptional about the abuse I suffered in that divorce court. It was just the way things were done then, and to some degree even today. But that started me on the path of trying to understand the law. And I knew I'd suffered a great injustice, and I thought that it would take me somewhere between a year and a half and 3 years of studying the law, and then I would rectify that injustice. So I got the books, and I started reading, and I started trying to understand. I'll tell you, my confusion just got deeper and deeper, and the more you read, the less you seemingly understood. And even when you did understand things, it leads to more things, and it just seemed endless. And the truth of the matter is I never did rectify that injustice. But it developed an appetite for studying the law. And one thing led to another, and I think the biggest surprise in all of this, I became a political activist in fathers' rights groups and that sort of thing. And studying the law, the big surprise is the reason I studied the law is I wanted an axe. I wanted a broadsword. I wanted a weapon where I would learn the law and I would use it as a weapon to go back and chop my adversaries into chunks. You understand? I was going to inflict vengeance on these people, and I was going to use the law as the means for doing that. Well, it never did. That never worked for me. But the surprise is that I did not start this out as a holy roller. I was not particularly spiritual. I went to church once in a while and the rest of that, but I mean, it was just a casual thing with me. The big surprise is that you study the law long enough, and it will bring you kicking and screaming back to God, whether you want to go there or not. You begin to see the biblical principles at the base of the law. And it was the most surprising thing, and it was the great blessing out of all of this. It's changed my life. Never rectified the injustice, but I guarantee you I got a lot closer to the good Lord. So one thing led to another. We started a little group called Citizens for Legal Reform in Dallas, half a dozen people meeting in Doris Bowman's living room back in 1990. And we decided we'd create a newsletter, and I was going to be in charge of the newsletter, and there were several other people involved. And I came up with the name Adi Shyster, and nobody else wanted to use it because they thought it was too radical. Might be misunderstood, and I knew in my gut that was the one I had to have. So I just made up my mind, all right, I'll produce my own newsletter, that's all. I started producing that magazine, and I thought I was pretty smart. This is 1990, you understand. And I started producing that magazine. And through dumb luck and the grace of God, I got national attention out of the first issue. And let me tell you what my distribution plan was. I printed up 10,000 copies. And I did it with desktop publishing, which was relatively new at the time. And my distribution plan is that I would just take stacks of the magazine and stick them out on street corners in Dallas and put a rock on top of them and hope somebody picked them up and read them. That was my distribution plan. But what happened is people heard about the magazine, and they came to me and they said, you know, I'm going on a vacation to Tennessee. Can I take 500 copies with you? I said, sure. Somebody else is going to Wyoming. Might have taken 1,000 copies. And before I was done, the magazine effectively walked across the country all by itself. And then I got written up in major news magazines and newspapers, and one thing led to another, and all of a sudden, I'd been a roofer up until then. And yada, yada. start producing the magazine, and that's when my education really began. I thought I was smart up until then, but I didn't realize how stupid I was, how ignorant I was, until I started publishing the magazine, and then people started writing in and helping to educate me. Published the magazine for 12 years. One thing led to another, and here I am. You know, I mean, it's just been a political activist. Now I've been engaged in this for 28 years, and here we are. And finally, after 28 years, I started this out back in, again, 1983, thinking I needed to get on 60 Minutes to tell them about this gross injustice. And sure enough, I finally got onto 60 Minutes. But it didn't work quite the way I had anticipated. Not the way I'd hoped, anyway. And it was in this last Sunday. I was interviewed on March 16th. And they broadcast excerpts from the interview this last Sunday. And the reason they were fascinated or intrigued or whatever with bringing me in is I'd done a radio program where I'd pointed out that the purpose for the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, was to shoot politicians and police officers and government employees. And when they heard that I'd said that in one of my radio programs, they said, "Oh, my God, we've got a crazy man here who thinks he's got to shoot everybody." And they took an excerpt from that program out of context. And they said, "But you said that. These are your words, aren't you?" They said, "You said this." I said, yeah, I said that. But I said other things as well. Right? I wasn't advocating that people use the Second Amendment as an excuse to go out and shoot the police. It is not a license to just shoot anybody you don't like. That's not what it's about. But it is a protection that was provided by the founders as a last resort in the event that the government becomes despotic. It becomes tyrannical. You can see some evidence of this. You can go back and start in the Declaration of Independence. And they are talking, probably about the fourth paragraph. It says, "In part, prudence indeed will dictate that the governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes. And accordingly, all experience hath shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed." That's an absolute fact. People put up with an endless amount of crap from their government before they finally get up off the couch and say, "All right, you SOBs, here we come." Right? They will put up with an endless amount of them. And it's unfortunate on one level. But the Declaration continues. It says, "But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security." The big line here is that it is their right, it is their duty to throw off despotic government. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off despotic government. How do you throw off a government that's engaged in despotism or tyranny? And it won't be done at the ballot box. By definition, the government won't pay attention to what happens at the ballot box. So what do? I mean, they are telling you it is your duty to throw off despotic government. That's principle in the Declaration of Independence in 1776, and in the Bill of Rights, 1791, 16 years later, thereabouts, they're providing the means to throw off that despotic government, and that's the Second Amendment. And the other part, there is a preamble to the Bill of Rights. And you can look this up if you've never seen it or heard the term before. You go up on Google and you can just put a preamble to Bill of Rights. You'll come up with it within a couple of clicks. You'll see it. It's the document that was added to the Bill of Rights as an introduction by the Congress when the amendments that ultimately became the Bill of Rights were first proposed. And it says in part, "The conventions of a number of the states, having at the time of their adopted the Constitution, expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers that further declaratory and restrictive clauses should be added. The purpose, these restrictive clauses, these declaratory and restrictive clauses are the Bill of Rights. These were created for the purpose, they're telling, in order to prevent misconstruction or abuse of its powers. Who could abuse or misconstrue the powers of the Constitution of the United States? And the answer is the government of the United States. They're the only ones. I can't misconstrue those powers. I don't have them. The powers of the Constitution are, for all practical purposes, granted to the newly created federal government. And the only people who could abuse the powers of the Constitution are those officers, officials, employees of the federal government. And the purpose of the Bill of Rights was to prevent misconstruction and abuse of those powers. The Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights. It provides for people to keep and bear arms, and the purpose is to prevent the federal government from becoming despotic, or at least to prevent them from abusing and misconstruing their powers and essentially becoming tyrannical. What could you do with the Second Amendment? What could it possibly be there for, given that the purpose is to keep the federal government in line, as found in the preamble to the Bill of Rights? Given that the purpose is to keep the federal government in line, what could it possibly mean other than shoot the SOBs if they get too far out of line? Well, I tried to explain that to 60 Minutes, and I did explain it in the course of the two-hour interview. And I also wrote an article and sent it to them, and they had all this information. And they proceeded in the interview that was recorded, that was aired this last Sunday. They nevertheless quoted the section from the radio program I did where I said the purpose of the Bill of Rights is to shoot politicians and police officers and so on. And they made much of that, and they said, Alfred Adams says he doesn't advocate violence, but why did he say this? Well, he didn't say that exactly. I said it. I said the words, but they weren't the only words I said. They took this out of context. And as a result, I've had quite a lot of attention. And this attention is on the one hand a little bit scary, and on the other hand, it's provided a great opportunity to communicate some ideas to the public. I'm getting more attention than I've ever had before. And most of the people hearing and most of the comments I've received on it have been, oh, I'd say 95% of the comments I've received, maybe 98%. Yeah, probably more like 98%. Are all positive, and they say, I saw they were trying to smear you, they're trying, but they thank God and so on that somebody's standing up. I don't think 60 Minutes did a very good job of discrediting and defaming me, although that was apparently their purpose. I was a little bit surprised. They're not all that competent. They're not all that good, at least not in this particular instance. I've seen, you know, the almighty 60 Minutes. I've watched them since I was a kid. And all of a sudden, I saw the little man behind the curtain. For the first time, I've been watching the great and powerful Oz for all these years. And now, for the first time, I saw the little man behind the curtain. And, you know, these guys aren't that bad. And by bad, I mean, you know, you understand in the slang sense. So, to associate
the preamble is... The preamble to the Bill of Rights is very, very important, and I keep bringing that to people's attention because so many times you see the Constitution printed without the preamble even being printed, mm-hmm. and it really is a key to understanding the Bill of Rights.
I understand that. I understand. It tells you the purpose of the Bill of Rights, and it tells you another thing also. I don't know if you subscribe to the notion that they have apparently replaced the states of the Union with a set of territories. Is that something that you're familiar with?
No.
All right. There's reason to suspect that the government of the United States, the federal government, has essentially rendered the states insolvent and non-functional, or at least the governments of the states, and they have supplanted them with a set of territories. And what passes for Texas today isn't the state of Texas, but rather an administrative territorial district. I subscribe to that theory. I believe it to be correct, but I can't prove it absolutely. We can see plenty of evidence to support it. If it were true, one of the things about the Bill of Rights is that it at least implies that the conventions of a number of states, having at the time of their adopted the Constitution expressed a desire in order to prevent misconstruction and abuse of its powers, yada, yada, that these further declaratory and restrictive clauses be added. It is quite possible and even probable, not necessarily true, but at least probable, that the Bill of Rights is only intended to apply to the states of the Union. If those states were no longer functional and they'd been replaced by territories, the Bill of Rights wouldn't apply in this new territorial venue. This may explain the recent case up in Indiana where the Supreme Court ruled the cops can kick in the door anytime they want, and even if it's illegal, there's still nothing you can do about it. The Fourth Amendment doesn't protect in the territories, perhaps it only protects within the states of the Union. If you're not familiar with this idea, and it certainly sounds fantastic, and I understand it's hard to believe even for me, right? I don't advocate this idea without just, oh, yeah, they've created these territories. No, this is something we've been looking at for a decade. And there is reason to believe a high probability that this theory is roughly correct. I think the reason for it goes back to Article 1, Section 10, Clause 1 of the Constitution of the United States, which declares in part, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. It does not declare no territory can make this gold and silver coin, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. In territories, you use anything you want. You can use corn cobs, you can use even Federal Reserve worthless pieces of paper in the territories. But within the states of the Union, you've got to have gold and silver coin. That restriction, again, only applies to the states of the Union, doesn't apply to the federal government, doesn't apply to the territories. When the government removed the gold from circulation in 1933, the only thing we had left was silver in domestic circulation. They stopped redeeming silver certificates for silver in 1968, and they stopped coining silver dollars and so on in 1964. At that point in time, there was no longer any lawful tender in circulation. There was no longer gold, there was no longer silver in circulation. And my question is, how did the governments of the states of the Union continue to function without gold and silver currency in circulation? Because the Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. How can a government of a state of the Union pay its debts without gold and silver coin? How can a government of the state of the Union impose a fine or a fee or a tax in a currency that is not gold and silver coin, without violating the Constitution of the United States? Constitution says no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debt. That's never been amended. So long as that's true, in my opinion, one of two things has to be true. Either what passes for government of the states of that we are familiar with right now, either if that is still the government of a state of the Union, that government acts unconstitutionally every time it imposes a tax, a fine, a fee that's denominated in anything other than gold and silver coin. It acts unconstitutionally every time it writes a check to its help, its employees, officers, and so on. If it's not in gold and silver, it's unconstitutional. Article 1, no state shall make anything but gold and silver coin, a tender in payment of debt. The state governments have to have gold and silver coin. Again, if there's no gold and silver coin, then one of two things appears to me to be true. Either the states are acting unconstitutionally, the governments of the states are acting unconstitutionally every single time they touch a Federal Reserve note, or what passes for the governments of the states are no longer governments of the states of the Union. They are something else. For example, if they were territories, if they were deemed to be territories with names like TX and OK and CA and NY and so on, and zip codes. Within those territories, it would be acceptable to use something other than gold and silver coin. There's no restriction in the territories against using gold and silver coin. If you took the gold out under the pretext of a national emergency and you sustained that emergency now for over 70 years, took it out back in 1933, what, we're 74, 75 years we've had living in a state of emergency. Under that state of emergency, that might be sufficient pretext to say, oh my gosh, the governments of the states can't function lawfully. The federal government, however, could function if these were territories, and under the state of emergency, we'll just presume the whole thing be territorial. I can't tell you that that is God's truth. That's the way it looks probable to me. But one of two things has to be true. Your state government, every time it touches a Federal Reserve note, is either, if it's a government, if it's the government that was created under the Constitution, it is truly a government of a state of the union, then it violates the Constitution. It's unconstitutional every time it touches a Federal Reserve note, or what passes for government at what passes for a state, that isn't a real deal anymore. It's some sort of a private entity, a territorial entity. It's something other than the states of the union.
Well, it's there's a conversation going on in our chat room about, you know, all private employers who withhold taxes being withholding agents, and basically anybody that participates in that is basically consenting to this de facto government.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. I think one of the keys, if you denominate, for example, if you go to court and you sue people, and you are suing them for Federal Reserve notes, all right, I'm going to sue for $100,000. I'm going to sue for $1 million. By implication, you're saying I'm suing within the territory. And if you are, you may not have all of the protections that you think you have. The Bill of Rights may not apply. There are a whole bunch of things may happen if you're in the territory. One of the things that happens in the territories is under Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2 of the Constitution, it gives the Congress exclusive legislative jurisdiction over the territories. And it reduces what passes, if it were true that what passes for the state of Texas has really been reduced to a territory, for example, or the state of Colorado or the state of California, for example. If that were true, then the local government would simply be an administrative arm under Title V of the United States Code. It'd just be administrative agencies of the federal government operating these territories. And there's reason to suspect that, as improbable as these ideas sound, there's reason to suspect they might be true. Let me give you an example. Here in Texas, you can pick up the Texas Penal Code. And if you look at Article 1, which is General Provisions, and Subsection 4, actually, it's Article 1.04, 0.04 deals with territorial jurisdiction. And if you look under subsection D, in other words, Texas Penal Code 1.04, subsection D, and it defines the territorial jurisdiction of this state. And it says, this state includes the land and the water, and the airspace above the land and the water, over which this state has power to define offenses. Now, this state appears to be code. The term this state, at least as used in government documents since, say, 1970. Prior to that, it may have been used innocently. Since then, when you see the word this state as opposed to the state, it appears that this state may be code for this alternative territorial venue. And in the section of the Texas Penal Code I just quoted, they say again, this state, which I believe to be the territorial venue, could be wrong, but I think that's what they're talking about, includes the land and the water and the airspace above the land and the water over which this state has power to define offenses. There are no geographic boundaries for this state. It doesn't say that this state ends at the Rio Grande with Mexico. It doesn't say that it ends with the Red River with Oklahoma. Okay? There are no limits. There are no geographic limits to the territorial jurisdiction of this state. It goes on, in theory, it goes on up into Canada. It goes on up to Mars. It is anywhere and everywhere where this state is empowered to define offenses. It has no geographic limits. And also, this definition doesn't include any people. It's all about definitions. This state includes the land and the water and the airspace above the land and the water over which this state has power to define offenses. If you accept their definitions, you're in this state. That's the implication. On the other hand, if you have a different set of definitions and you can establish that your definitions apply to the state of Texas, for example, or the state of California or the state of Minnesota and so on, you've got a different set of definitions. In theory, it suggests you're not in this state. You're not caught in this administrative territorial venue. Now, all of this, as I know, it's not just hard to understand. It's hard to believe, and I guarantee it's not just hard for you folks to believe. It's hard for me to believe. I stand here telling you this stuff knowing that there are people shaking their heads and say, oh, my God, the man must have lost his mind. He must be crazy. What's he talking about? Well, I may be mistaken, but I'm not crazy, at least not to the extent that I'm certifiable. You understand? And it's kind of a joke, but what I'm getting to in part is the world is much different than we're led to believe. And insofar as you accept their definitions, you are caught in a venue that you will not recognize or understand. It's presumed you get it. It's presumed you know what's going on, but if we're correct, almost no one does. And this is consistent. If you've been to court, you may see some very strange things happen. You may walk out in a state of shock, wondering, how the heck did that happen to me? What the heck happened back there? Well, what happened is you got tried in a territorial court rather than a court of one of the states of the Union. That's what may have happened. That might be an explanation. It could be mistaken, but it might be an explanation. Does that make any sense to you, Todd?
Well, it makes a lot of sense, and frankly, it probably makes a lot of sense to a lot of our regular listeners. We got a pretty savvy group of folks that regularly tune in here. So, I mean, to some extent, when we preach here, we're preaching to the choir. But we've got a lot of guests and a lot of callers that are not in our chat room tonight. So I imagine we've got a good group of people listening that are not our regulars. But what I'm saying is that you're talking to a bunch of people who really understand what you're saying and are already there and beyond there.
Okay. We can see more evidence of this.
You could speak in an advanced mode.
Well, it's not necessarily an advanced mode, except in the sense that, you know, I'm out there exploring uncharted territory, and I'm not the only one who's doing it. There's other people that are doing it also, but it's not exactly, you know, I don't ever tell people to believe what I'm telling you, right? I don't ever tell you, look, this is God's truth, and you must believe it. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, look, this is the way it appears to me. I don't doubt for a minute that my knowledge is imperfect. I have more to learn. But I also understand that I've learned quite a lot up until now. And we've had successes. I ran for the Supreme Court of the state of Texas back in 1992 and received 201,000 votes, which isn't really a large number, but the fact that it was amazing that I got on the ballot. Because the Texas Constitution says you have to be a judge for 10 years before at lower court, before you can run for the Supreme Court. You have to be a licensed attorney. I'm neither. I found an 1870 federal law that allowed me to run for the state Supreme Court of Texas. And I used that argument, and they let me on the ballot. I'm probably the first non-attorney to get on the ballot for Texas Supreme Court since maybe the Civil War. Pardon?
Did you have to show your birth certificate?
No, I didn't have to do any of that. It was just, I made a certain argument, and it was, I never expected that they'd let me on the ballot. I saw something. I said, you know, if this is true, I read this 1870 federal law that readmitted Texas back into representation in Congress after the Civil War. And part of it said that our rights were guaranteed to be forever, at a minimum, at the level that existed in 1870. And I said, well, I know damn well you didn't have to be a licensed attorney, because there weren't any back in 1870. So that implies you don't have to be a licensed attorney. I still have the right under federal law to run for the Supreme Court of Texas. I don't have to be a licensed attorney. And at the time, there was no requirement that you be a judge at a lower court for 10 years. So I said, well, if that was the truth then, it's still the truth now. Federal law. All right, it was a condition for readmitting Texas back into the Congress after the Civil War. So I used that argument, and you get on the ballot. And the point I'm trying to make, it's one of a handful of instances where I've had to confront the government, and so far I've been successful. It doesn't mean I've ever won any money or whatever, but I've had unusual successes. Sometimes they're mixed successes. I was arrested by two police officers who entered my house without warrant. They arrested me without warrant. They caused me ultimately to be extradited to Missouri from my home in Texas. Caused me to be extradited to Missouri based on allegations of two felony counts of non-support of a child. I knew that the allegations were fraudulent. Right? And went to Missouri, and I did a couple of things on it, but I was in jeopardy of being convicted of two felonies. And each one carried a maximum penalty of 5 years in the slammer. In theory, I could have been facing 10 years in the slammer. As a practical matter, I would probably, if I'd been found guilty, I would probably have been out in 6 months or less. I did some things that I understood when I signed the waiver of extradition. And there were some things that happened, and eventually I signed a waiver of extradition, and they extradited me up to Missouri. But I signed that waiver of extradition at arm's length, because I understand that the term at arm's length means you're acting in a non-fiduciary capacity. And I understood that child support is essentially a breach of a fiduciary obligation. And I also signed under my signature, it was written, true name, Alfred Adisk. The name was capitalized rather than all uppercase. And then AKA, also known as, quotes, open quote, Alfred N. Adisk, close quote, and the Alfred N. Adisk was all uppercase. Now, when they got me up to Missouri, all of a sudden they couldn't prosecute me. And they held me for 344 days. That's not the sort of thing where you say, oh boy, what a victory. And you spent 344 days in a level 5 maximum security jail. But in the end, they simply released me. The judge wouldn't even let me in his courtroom. They released me. They tried to get me to take an attorney. I refused to take an attorney. And eventually, after a certain amount of fencing back and forth, the judge, they were having a hearing, and everybody was there. But they wouldn't bring me out of the cage outside the courtroom and put me in the courtroom. I wanted to go. I wanted to show them what I got. They wouldn't have it. So they threw me out, dismissed the charges, and away I go. Now, I could be a convicted felon today. And people could order me to urinate in a cup, you know, from time to time. I'm not. And I doubt that there's many people around you can point to and say, ha-ha, this guy was in jail, all right, for 344 days, and the state just dropped the case against him. And that hasn't happened very often. It's one thing, a lot of people, you can defeat these things, you can stop prosecutions in some instances if you get to them early on and before you get to court. But once you've been incarcerated, the state doesn't want to admit that they screwed up. They want you to take a plea bargain. They want you to take a deal. They got to get something where you let them off the hook. I wouldn't let them off the hook. And in part because I knew from the moment I was arrested that this was a good Lord's business. I knew the good Lord was taking me out of my home, and whatever was going on was going on. I went to Missouri. I thought I'd be there 10 days. I thought the people in Texas were crazy. They were arresting me without warrant and the rest of that sort of thing. I thought, these guys are nuts. I'll go to Missouri, and they'll be reasonable in Missouri. And I got to Missouri, and they were crazier than the people in Texas. But in any case, they held me betting that I would break and roll over and take an attorney and take a plea bargain, take a deal, do something. And I just sat there, and because I understood the good Lord wanted me in that slammer, he was putting me there. I was quite content. It was one of the most fertile intellectual periods of my life. I learned more in those 344 days that I was in that jail than I have in any other, you know, any other 344 days in my life. I was closer to God than I'd ever been before. I told people, you know, a number of times, I said, if I had known how much I would gain out of going to jail, I would have fought my way in years ago. I don't want to go back. You know, I have no interest in going back. It may come to that if that's what the good Lord wants, so I'm ready to go. And it didn't disturb me to be there because I understood that's what the good Lord wanted. I just never thought I was going to be there for 344 days. I thought it was going to be a couple of weeks and I'd be back home. Surprise, surprise. But and the biggest... There's other instances I could talk about, but the biggest one and the most important one for tonight is after I came back from Missouri. And I was in the process of preparing a lawsuit to sue them for false imprisonment. I got involved with some people who were being sued by the Attorney General of the state of Texas for the manufacture and distribution. Yeah.
Before we go there, we've got a couple of callers that have got their hands up, and I want to be able to really focus on where you're going. But before you go there, I think we might have a couple of questions from people, and I think we probably ought to deal with those for a few minutes and then come back to where you're headed.
That's fine.
Area code 724.
Hi, Terry.
Area code 724.
Yeah,
who's that?
You got me? It's
yes.
Dwayne.
Hi, Dwayne.
Yeah, I have a question. How are you, Terry? Your call has got a lot of beautiful things to say. I'm encouraged by his courage for the Father, as we do love him on this call. I do have a question for you. You talk about territories, and I'm just curious as to whether these are somehow aligned with the, shall we say, the corporations that the southern states were brought back into after the Civil War. Are these the same territories, per se, or are these a whole different layer than we're used to?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by as we're used to. But this whole issue of corporate and unincorporate, all that by itself, that is confusing, and it may have functioned contrary to what people begin, but what people think. Go ahead and go ahead, man. What you were going to say? Something?
Yeah, with the assemblies, basically, we understand the difference between de jure and de facto. For instance, people are under the impression that the boundaries, the physical boundaries, remain the same. The state has basically changed hands from a republic of common law to a de jure. Or, I'm sorry, to a de facto democracy type of a usurpation. Although it's basically the same territories, boundary-wise, physical boundaries. When you say the word territory, I want to make sure that we're talking apples and apples here. Is that the same territory that covered the state, or does it have physical boundaries that go into other states, creating a whole new gerrymandered type of a territory?
I think what we're dealing with is a single territory that covers the entire, that at minimum covers the entire United States. And what passes for the state of Colorado, for example, is not, it doesn't have absolute borders and boundaries the way the State of the Union did. It is merely a territorial jurisdiction. It's kind of like a franchise from McDonald's. You might own a franchise, you might have a franchise from McDonald's at one point. So I got a franchise from McDonald's a mile down the road. Our customers can come from anywhere. the boundaries are there, but they're more like a recommendation than an absolute fact. They do not truly limit jurisdiction the way a lot of people suppose they would. And there's some evidence to support this idea. People sometimes see things where people are reaching out. For example, in my case, when I was extradited from Texas to Missouri, there was no warrant for my arrest. There was no warrant for my extradition. It was done on nothing more than a teletype. They sent essentially an email from Missouri down to the local police at Carrollton, Texas, where I was living at the time, and they said, go get this guy. That's all they had. They didn't have a warrant, and it didn't even disturb them that they didn't have a warrant. And part of the thing I learned is, I haven't looked at this for a while, but it'll take me just a moment here to pull this up, the extradition. Yeah, here it is. Article 4 deals with extradition. And this is one of the things I learned in the aftermath of being extradited up to Missouri. Didn't know it at the time, but I learned it later. Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution of the United States. It says, a person charged in any state with treason, felony, or other crime, who shall flee from justice and be found in another state, shall on demand of the executive authority of the state from which he fled be delivered up to be removed to the state having jurisdiction of the crime. Extradition is about moving people from one state of the union to another state of the union, at least under Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2. And it applies to a person charged with treason, felony, or other crime. You've got to be charged. I was never even charged with a crime. I was extradited anyway. How is that possible? Take a look at Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3. Now, this section was allegedly superseded by the 13th Amendment, which outlawed slavery. And people look at Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3 as just an historical appendage to the Constitution that doesn't count anymore, but in fact it does, in my opinion. It says, no person held to service or labor in one state under the laws thereof escaping to another shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. This applies not only to slaves. That's what it was here for. If a slave escaped from one state to another, all that happened, if I owned a slave, I didn't have to charge him with a crime. The first section I read to you, you had to be charged with a crime. A charge requires two or more witnesses. You got to get a couple people together, and there has to be a probable cause hearing. Where I say, Terry Dodd, he broke the law, this, that, and that, and we have to generate a charge for extradition under Article 4, Section 2, Clause 2. But for slaves, you don't need a charge. You only need a claim. Shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. It means one man, under Article 4, Section 2, Clause 3, can cause someone to be extradited back to wherever he came from, based on a mere claim, says, yeah, that's my slave. Send him back. Don't need to go through any probable cause hearing. Don't need an indictment. Don't need a charge. Let's just say, hey, send him. This is essentially what happened to me in this particular case, and in my particular case. I was never charged with a crime, but I was extradited, never had a warrant. I think they brought me up under the pretext that I had entered into a servitude, that I had voluntarily agreed to become a fiduciary in a matter of child support. And when I signed those documents the way I did at arm's length, and the documents were signed by the judge down here in Dallas and sealed by the Dallas court, and I was accepted at that capacity, non-fiduciary capacity, when they extradited me up to Missouri, they had taken me up in the capacity of a non-fiduciary for what was a fiduciary offense. Now, I didn't fully understand things then to the degree that I understand them today, and I might not fully understand them yet, but the point I'm trying to make is that this is at least one of the aberrations that appears to be going on in this country. Your extradition today is between territories and it's based on the presumption that you are merely a fiduciary, not a slave, but the 13th Amendment only prohibits slavery and involuntary servitude. But if they presume you to have voluntarily entered into a servitude of being a fiduciary, if it's presumed that you volunteered, then they can still extradite you on the claim, just the claim of one person. Just say, hey, that's my fiduciary. Send him up here. Well, apparently, I don't know if that's, I know that's hard to follow, but that's apparently what happened to me. I don't know if that's helpful or I lost track of your point, but if the caller's here and he wants a clarification or he wants me to try to actually get back on target here, I'd be happy to try to do so.
I think it helps answer it. I was looking, when you were saying in this state, and you're using that as a guideline there, the way you were describing it, this state, and the extradition, you're basically talking about a basically abstract federal territory then, almost. Is that
Yeah. Okay.
I just want to make sure that we're talking apples and apples here, because make sure, there's a lot of people on the call that, and Terry and Red will understand this, that out of the assemblies will think that when you're talking territories, are you talking about a state territory? So I just want to make sure we're clarifying those things.
No, I'm talking about a single federal territory that extends across the entire what passes for United States, plus the District of Columbia, plus Guam, Puerto Rico, U.S. Virgin Islands.
Right.
All right. Whatever it is, it's part of the territory of Congress, is part of the same territory, so far as I'm able to understand.
Right. And he's basically represented by the by the District of Columbia. Okay. I just wanted to clarify that, because a lot of people haven't heard this term territory you're using. I want to make sure that we got it all laid out correctly, that's all. But I'll yield the floor, but I just want to let you know that I was one of the ones that helped push your interest for that preview I saw. I was one of the ones that was pretty upset in seeing the preview they were setting out of the trailer for you. And
yep.
I had a feeling it was going to be a slaughter job. So, so far it looks like you're doing pretty well. I just want to commend you. Thanks for your courage.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Appreciate the compliment.
Dwayne, thank you very much. We're going to leave you live, but let you drop back in the background and jump back in if you want to later. Area code 304, you've got your hand up.
Oh, yes. Can I be heard?
You can.
Am I heard? Hello?
Yes.
I can hear you.
Oh, thank you, Alfred. My real name is Jim Lovell. I've talked to you about the International Property Maintenance Code. It was rolled out first statewide in West Virginia. It's statewide in Texas. They can find you out of your house. There's a sole interpreter called the code official. I know a fellow who has two PhDs in law, works at the State Supreme Court of West Virginia. He had never heard of it. Several representatives had never heard of it being passed as anything. International Property Maintenance Code. Now, if in fact West Virginia was a territory as opposed to a state, would the, for instance, New York State, I found out that the governor passed the International Property Maintenance Code statewide there also by administrative decree. If he were the administrator of a territory, could he just pass a law as such? And I'll just
absolutely.
Okay.
This goes to the heart. This is a powerful insight. If it's true that there's a dichotomy between the state, meaning the state of the union, and this state, meaning the territory, they are passing all kinds of laws. They're absolutely legal in the territory, but they're not legal within the state.
Now, if you
can't control your venue, they're going to presume you're in this state and the laws are going to apply to you. But if you can raise an effective argument that, no, I'm within the state of Texas or within the state of West Virginia, if you can make that argument, you're in a different venue. Those laws don't apply in that venue, or at least that's our theory.
Okay. Now, question. Okay. Would you be willing to dig into this and figure out if that's how they passed the International Property Maintenance Code? Because it's worse than the banker bailout. I broke it on the Derry Brownfield show on July 14, 2006. We lost him not long ago. Well, the bottom line is very simple. If you were to pursue how on the earth this was passed, because it is worse than the banker bailout. There's $40 trillion worth of private real estate, residential and commercial in the United States, roughly speaking, and they can steal anything they want with the International Property Maintenance Code. They make you tear down the structure at your expense while you're in jail. if you were to pursue this, that might give you some more ammunition. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Jim.
Thank you very much, Jim. Well, let's get back to where you were talking about before. Maybe we should start out with the Food and Drug Act of 1906.
Well, let me lay the foundation for this. Let me do the story on how this turned up in the first place.
You have the floor.
Again, after I was released from the Missouri jail, I came back up here and I came back to Texas. I was in the process of suing him for false imprisonment. But I also became, a lawsuit had started in 2001 where a husband, a wife, and their corporation had been sued by the Attorney General of Texas for $25,000 a day per defendant, each of them. The husband up for $25,000 a day, wife up for $25,000, corporation up for $25,000. That's $9 million per defendant per year. Understand? Serious money. Because these people had been manufacturing and distributing colloidal silver. Colloidal silver, most of your audience probably understands, it's an inexpensive antibiotic that consists of distilled water and silver ions. These people had been distributing colloidal silver, and the FDA asked the Texas Attorney General and the Texas Department of State Health Services to sue them and shut them down, and they proceeded to go after them. They spent $160,000 on attorneys to defend them at one of the best law firms in Texas, and all they got for their money was they were driven into bankruptcy. And the stress of the whole thing caused the husband and wife to divorce, and the two of them ultimately left Texas for parts unknown. Before they left, they sold some of their equipment and inventory to another man. Right? And the Attorney General therefore added him as a defendant. He was also going to sell colloidal silver. He didn't buy their business, but he did buy some of their inventory. They added him and his trust and his corporation as a defendant. Three more defendants. Now they have six defendants, each one, $25,000 a day, $9 million a year. He heard about me doing radio programs. And somebody said, you got to call Alan, maybe he can help. And I agreed to help him, and I got involved, and I was involved in this from 2005 through 2007. I was brought in 2005. And in part because I got involved in this, it kind of came to a head at the same time my statute of limitations expired on the false imprisonment thing. And I was elevated to the status of a defendant. I volunteered to be fiduciary for the trust that was a defendant, and therefore they named me as a defendant, which surprised me. I've come to understand that was absolutely legal. I didn't understand it at the time, but now I'm a defendant, and I'm faced with charges of $25,000 a day, $9 million a year, for the manufacture and distribution of a controlled substance called colloidal silver. This is the same law they're using to charge people for distributing methamphetamine, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, the rest of that sort of thing. Same law. I read the relevant law. And particularly, I read the definition of drugs, right? For example, I don't remember which one I read first, either the Texas law or the federal law. But the first time I read it, I thought, why the damn fools? They don't even know what they're writing. Look at how stupid this is. I'm going to read this to you right now. This is from the Texas Health and Safety Code, section 431.002, subparagraph 14. Okay, again, Texas Health and Safety Code, section 431.002, subparagraph 14. And we're being charged under this, and I am reading this from a document that was produced by the Attorney General of Texas. It says the key to this case lies in determining at law, and not as a matter of fact, whether the defendant's colloidal products met the definition of a drug when mislabeled, falsely advertised, and sold as products intended to treat disease. And then Texas Health and Safety Code 431.002, subsection 14. And they're quoting it here, and it says, drug means articles recognized in the official United States Pharmacopoeia National Formulary or any supplement to it, articles designed or intended for the use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in man or other animals. Articles other than food intended to affect the structure or any function of the body of man or other animals. And articles intended for use as a component in any of any article specified in the subdivision. There's a little more, but the magic words for me, I saw man or other animals. I thought, why, you people are crazy. That means you think the people are animals. I thought it was just stupid. If I am halfway fluent in the English language, and I understand that if you say man or animals, it's like saying black or white. You got two different categories here. But if you say black or other white, you're essentially saying that black is a subset of white, right? It's a completely different thing. In the same sense, when we say man or animals, okay, we've got man over on one side, we've got animals on the other side. They're mutually exclusive. When you say man or other animals, you are saying man is a subset. He is a kind of animal. There is a large category of animals that includes lions and tigers and bears and man. Well, I read that, and I am a student of the Bible. I'm not a scholar, but I'm a student. And I understand that on the sixth day, God created man in his image and gave man dominion over the animals. I can't be an animal under the Christian, Jewish, and probably Muslim faiths. And anyone who calls me an animal violates my freedom of religion. Well, again, I saw this the first time, man or other animals, and the first thing I thought, why, you idiots, you morons, look what you've written. And then I read the federal definition of drugs. And here I am, I'm quoting again from the Attorney General's paperwork, and it says, the federal code, upon which the state code is based and which is virtually identical, is 21 U.S.C. Section 321, subsection G, subparagraph 1. I'll read that again if anybody wants to write this down or try to get it. You look at this up. You can find this yourself and read it and see if I'm telling the truth or not. Title 21 of the United States Code. And the site is 21 U.S.C., meaning United States Code, Section 321, subsection G, and subparagraph 1. And it provides in pertinent part. The term drug means, A, articles recognized in the official United States Pharmacopoeia, official homeopathic pharmacopoeia of the United States, or official national formulary, or any supplement to any of them, and B, articles intended for the use in the diagnosis, cure, mitigation, treatment, or prevention of disease in man or other animals, and C, articles other than food intended to affect the structure or any function of the body of man or other animals, and D, articles intended for use as a component of any article specified in clause A, B, or C. There's more to it, but that's all I want to focus. Again, here's the federal law. The definition of drugs applies to man, not man or animals, but man or other animals. They're telling you that they deem man to be an animal. Again, when I saw it the second time, that's when I realized this isn't an accident. I saw it at the Texas level, and I said, the damn fools. Then I saw it at the federal level, and I said, oh, my gosh, this is not an accident. They deem the people to be animals. And again, takes me right back to the Bible. My first stop is the Bible on this. Genesis 1, 26 through 28. On the sixth day, God created man in his image and gave man dominion over the animals. That clearly specifies that under the Jewish, Christian, and probably Muslim faiths, I assume the Muslims are operating on the same premise, but I don't know that to be true, But man and man alone is made in God's image, and he's given dominion over the animals. Man can't be an animal under the Jewish and Christian faiths. Right? If you're an animal, you're not a man. If you're a man, you're not an animal. You can't be a man and an animal under those faiths. Well, as soon as I saw that, I understood there's a religious freedom defense to these charges. I'm being threatened with $25,000 a day, $9 million a year, and I have a religious freedom defense against the drug laws. Right? We put this religious freedom defense together. And again, this is because the good Lord lets me see sometimes. This isn't because I'm particularly clever. This is because sometimes the good Lord lets me see. You understand? And what is particularly astonishing to me is, to the best of my knowledge, I'm the first one to read the drug laws and understand what they mean. Huh? At least the first layman and virtually first attorney. I'm the first one to read it and say, oh my gosh, the damn, they operate on the premise that we are animals. Why is that an important premise? I believe the answer is found in the Declaration of Independence. Declaration of Independence says, second, I'm going to give you what I regard as the two fundamental principles on which this country was founded. They're found in the second and third sentences of the Declaration of Independence. And the second sentence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Everyone's heard that. But very few people have gone on to the third sentence and realized what it means. Third sentence says that to secure these rights, which rights are they talking about? They're talking about the God-given, unalienable rights that were declared in the preceding sentence. Preceding sentence says, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Third sentence, that to secure these rights, the unalienable rights that we get from God, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. The first half of that sentence tells us the purpose of government, the prime directive for government as envisioned by the founders of this country. And the purpose was to secure these God-given, unalienable rights to every man, woman, and even unborn child. These rights attach, they are granted by your Creator. They attach at the moment of your creation. They do not attach at the moment of your birth, as in civil rights under the 14th Amendment. Under the Declaration of Independence, the child, the unborn child, has the unalienable right to life. Under the 14th Amendment, the citizen of the United States doesn't have, it says, all persons born or naturalized in the United States. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. 14th Amendment doesn't apply until you're born. You're not a 14th Amendment person until you have fully exited the birth canal. This is the reason why, in my opinion, that they can have partial birth abortions. They can scoop the baby's brains out when the baby is just seconds from being fully born. Until the baby has fully exited the birth canal, he has not been born. Until he's born, he doesn't have rights under the 14th Amendment. Under the Declaration of Independence, his rights attach as an attribute of his creation, not his birth. His creation is no later than his conception. There's a passage in Jeremiah where God's talking to Jeremiah, and he says, I knew you before you were in your mother's womb. That implies that we were created long before we were conceived. All right? But for sure, your creation begins with your conception. Under the principles and the Declaration of Independence, the purpose of government is to secure. It says that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men. It means government's business is to secure your God-given, unalienable rights every single time, even if you are too dumb, too ignorant, too young, unborn, and you can't assert those rights for yourself. It doesn't matter. Government must secure your God-given, unalienable rights. All right? It is the prime directive. and this is the foundation for calling it the land of the free. Government had to secure those rights, didn't matter what. This was the limits in limited government. Anytime anyone's God-given, unalienable rights were being infringed, deprived, denied, whatever, government had to step in and say, that's it, stop it. Even if you didn't request it, they had to protect those God-given, unalienable rights. But they only have to protect them for men. Again, it says we hold these truths to be self-evident to all men. That means men and women. All right? I'm not just talking about men, male. In that sense, all men are created equal and endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights. There is no such endowment for persons. There's no such endowment for inhabitants or citizens or any of the alternative names that you might that people might use to describe them. There's certainly no such endowment for animals. If they can treat you as an animal, you don't have any God-given unalienable rights. If you don't have any God-given unalienable rights, they have no obligation to secure them. Now, that's my theory as to why it's important to the system to declare us to be animals. I can't say that that's necessarily correct. I think it is, but, you know, what can you say? I mean, you come up with a lot of these hypotheses.
Good girl.
And you might be right and you might be wrong. But you're never going to get someone in a position of authority to come down and just say, well, boy, oh boy, you sure are a smarty. Well, you figured out the whole thing, and now you understand what's going on. Well, I want to congratulate you. They're never going to admit that. They will never admit your rights, so you're always working on the basis of inference. You're constantly in the mode, it walks like a duck and it quacks like a duck and so on, and so you have to conclude, I think we've got a duck here. But we aren't going to get anybody to tell us absolutely. No one in a position of authority will dare tell us, yep, that's a duck. You'll have to speculate. So all of you can take this speculation, and again, that's what it is. You have to take it with a certain amount of salt. You don't believe it because it comes from me, but this is a strong argument. And it's consistent with the idea that this is an attack, a spiritual attack. When they call us animals, this is not just a small thing. This is evidence of spiritual warfare. If you're an animal, you are not a man made in God's image. This is significant stuff. If you look at Genesis 9:6, and I don't have it right here in front of me where I can quote it directly, where I can quote it precisely, but if you look at Genesis 9:6, it tells you why you can't murder a man. Why is murder wrong? And the answer is because the man is made in God's image. That's why you can kill cows. We eat cows, no problem. Kill them, eat them, chickens, fish, you know. Push comes to shove, dogs and cats. You can kill them all, you know, if you have to and the rest of it. Why? They're not made in God's image. The reason you can't kill a man, the reason that constitutes murder, is because man is made in God's image. If they can strip you of your standing as a man made in God's image, guess what? You are now reduced to the status of cattle. You are livestock. And they can handle you the same way they handle chickens in a Tyson poultry processing plant. If they want to clip your little beak off so you can't poke the other chickens because they got you jammed in so tight you can barely stand it anymore without going mad, it doesn't matter. They can do it to you because you're nothing but a freaking animal. If you folks are willing to accept your status as animals, you are going to pay a terrible price. And the price gets even more interesting when you begin to consider the concept of genocide. Genocide, law on genocide, is that genocide doesn't require that you actually cause anyone to die. It is an act of genocide to merely create circumstances or conditions where it's more likely that a particular race or ethnic group or nation or religion or whatever. You create circumstances where they are more likely to die. That all by itself constitutes an act of genocide. When the Hutus decide to chop up the Tutsis up in Central Africa. They go into their wars every once in a while. You hear about them. First thing they do is declare the Tutsis to be animals. Even primitive people understand that if you recognize your adversary's humanity, if you recognize that they are men and women made in God's image, although they might not use that phrase, but nevertheless, if you recognize them as men and women, and particularly men and women made in God's image, you can't just go kill them. That's wrong. Right? Even primitive people get that. So they go ahead and they say, aha, the Tutsis are a bunch of animals. Once they are animals, then it justifies killing them all, not just the combatants, but the children and the women and the elderly. Kill them all. You can exterminate them like a hive of wasps or a nest of rats. It doesn't matter. You can kill little babies. You can kill the adults. You kill all of them. It doesn't matter because they're animals. You can do this in the Holocaust Nazi Germany. One of the conditions precedent for whatever happened over there to the Jews is that they first be defined as Untermenschen, meaning, and it meant under men, essentially. It meant a lower form of mankind. It essentially meant they defined the Jews to be animals. And if they were animals, yeah, you'd kill them all. You kill the women, the children, move them into the gas chamber. Kill them all. They're animals. It is the fundamental premise if you're going to commit genocide. And the Jews, of course, they've operated on a similar premise for much of their history. They've sat back and said, all those non-Jews, they're just goy. They're just animals. The Jews were denying the humanity. They denied that others were made in God's image. They're not made in God's image, and you can exploit them and use them any way you want. This is a fundamental tendency in human beings. When you're going out to get somebody, the first thing you do is deny their humanity. You deny that they are men and women made in God's image and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. So here we have a document. This is at genocidewatch.org. You can visit there yourself. And if you look, there's a there's a tab at the top that says About Genocide. And if you click on that tab, there'll be a menu that pops up. And there's a document there entitled 8 Stages of Genocide. And the point is that under the law, each of these stages constitutes an act of genocide. It's not necessary that people actually die. It's only necessary that you create conditions where it's more likely that they will die. That's genocide. And here's number 3 on the list. One group denies the humanity of the other group. Members of it are equated with animals, vermin, insects, or diseases. Dehumanization overcomes the normal human revulsion against murder. At this stage, hate propaganda in print and on hate radios is used to vilify the victim group. In combating this dehumanization, incitement to genocide should not be confused with protected speech. Genocidal societies lack constitutional protection for countervailing speech. And what they mean is if people try to stand up and say, no, I'm not an animal. I said, no, we don't have any protection for that. Where am I now? And should be treated differently than democracies. Local and international leaders should condemn the use of hate speech and make it culturally unacceptable. I can argue based on where we're going with this. By declaring the people to be animals in our drug laws, in our medical device laws, incidentally, that one also came into play in the particular suit I was involved in. That also defined the people to be animals. By declaring the people to be animals, our government has dehumanized us. Under the description of genocide produced by Gregory Stanton, president of Genocide Watch, this dehumanization all by itself constitutes an act of genocide. When the government declares in its law that you are nothing but an animal, they are increasing the probability that you may die. It is, if you apply the facts to the law, it is evidence that the government of the United States is committing genocide against the American people. as bizarre and hard to believe as that is a reasonable, rational, logical conclusion. Here's the problem. Government, their laws on genocide, government has declared that only the government can charge genocide. Under the laws established by the United States, I can't charge genocide. I can't take people to court and say, you people are committing genocide. All right? Now, I'm thinking about this, and I'm rolling this background in the back of my mind, and before I'm done, I'm going to find a way to do it. But under the laws that they have, they say only the government, the almighty, benign, and beneficent government, can charge genocide. That means I can't charge it, at least in theory. That's what it means. And, of course, the government is the one that's committing the genocide. They have structured the law much like if we sat back and said, only the bank robbers can charge bank robbery. I guarantee nobody's going to be charged with bank robbery. The bank robbers are not going to charge themselves. And in the same sense, the government that is producing genocide is not going to it's not going to charge itself with genocide. Well, there's more. This is 8 stages of genocide. It's worth reading, but the important point is that your government has defined you and your spouse and your parents and the people you love and admire and your children and your grandchildren to be animals. And if you are, you have no meaningful rights. One of the things that came out of the interview with 60 Minutes this last Sunday is I've had contact from people around the world. Right? Not a lot, but I don't know, half a dozen or 10 people from different parts of the world have seen that program and contacted me by email. And I've had one from England and one from Australia in particular. A guy down in Australia, he heard what I had to say on the 60 Minutes interview and in the 60 Minutes overtime section, talked about animals, and he came to my website or my blog, which incidentally is adask, A-D-A-S-K. .wordpress.com. If you want to see these articles on man or other animals, look in the categories section on the right-hand side of my blog and check on man or other animals. It's the very top listing up there. Check on that. It'll take you to about 10 different articles, maybe 12 I've written, that deal with genocide and the implication of this man or other animals thing. Where was I going? Guy from Australia. He calls up. Or doesn't call up. He sends me an email. He says, I heard what you said. I read what you said on your website. So I went and I looked at the Australian law. And he says, the Australian law defines drugs to apply to man or other animals. In fact, they use a different phrase, but it meant the same thing. We also found in this country, we found the phrase animals other than man. Sometimes they say man or other animals. Sometimes they say animals other than man. They both mean the same thing. They deem man to be an animal. Huh? The guy in Australia said, the law in Australia says the same thing. I can't remember the phrase, but it says the same thing. And then I've received email from someone who sent me 6 or 8 PDF files, official governmental files, that he claims I haven't had time to read yet, but he claims they also define the people of England to be animals. Now, what this tells me is that the presumption that the people are nothing but animals, this lays at the foundation of what is becoming the New World Order. The whole damn one world government is premised on the idea that you are nothing but an animal. You are not a man made in God's image. You are not endowed by your creator with certain unalienable rights, and there is no obligation on the part of government to secure them. I don't know if this is disturbing to the rest of you, but I guarantee it's disturbing to me. The government is committing genocide against the people of the United States, and it's not new. We chase this back, and the earliest instance of the man or other animals phrase is in 1906. In the 1906 Food and Drug Act, you can look this up on the Internet. You go to the Internet and type in 1906 Food and Drug Act. It'll take you to, you'll get to it in a link or two. It might take you to Wikipedia, for example, and you go down, you scroll down through Wikipedia article on the 1906 Food and Drug Act, and down at the bottom, there'll be a link to the text, the actual text of the act. If you look at paragraph 6 in the original Food and Drug Act from 1906, they define food to be that which is, I don't remember the entire definition, but that which is ingested, consumed, whatever, by man or other animals. They define drugs as those things that are consumed, ingested, whatever, by man or other animals. It says both food and drugs. If you're using food, if you're using drugs, you are presumed to be an animal. And that goes back to 1906. They've been at this for over a century right now. There are times when I wonder. Yeah, go ahead.
Two things. One, I'd like to let Red get in here for a few minutes. He's been quiet for an hour and 20 minutes, and that you know, I know he goes into the draw. But but also, we've got somebody mentioning in the chat room asking how this impacts standing. Could this be used as a defense or a claim that would grant standing, or do you believe? See, I see the concept of standing as being equivalent to this. They're in the same way that they are trying to render us as an animal. They also are trying to render us to have no standing. And basically, they both accomplish the same thing. But I'm not sure that you could use this as a defense. What do you think on that?
Well, we did use it again. I advanced this defense, and the Attorney General, before this was over, had invested 6 years and nearly $500,000 in the case I was talking about, where they were suing seven defendants for manufacturing and distribution of a controlled substance, and I was the last of seven defendants. I advanced this defense. I'd been involved in this thing for about a year at the time, and it took me that long to figure it out and put the paperwork together and advance a religious freedom defense. And I said, look, you can't charge me for violating a law that presumes me to be an animal without violating my freedom of religion. And I advanced a freedom of religion defense based on the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States and also Article 1, Section 6 of the Texas Constitution, which is also about freedom of religion. I said, you can't call me an animal without violating my religious freedom. My Bible says I'm a man made in God's image. I want to see the prosecutor who can stand up in court and tell a jury, no, ladies and gentlemen, you're just a pack of damn animals. You are not made in God's image. You are not given dominion over the animals. Let me see the prosecutor who thinks he can run that argument in a public forum. I would pay money to see the guy who is smart enough and sufficiently convincing that he can persuade a jury to admit that they are nothing but animals, and particularly they are therefore not made in God's image. I'd pay money to see that guy. We advanced this defense, and up until that time, we'd been receiving certified mail from the Attorney General's office every 2 to 6 weeks. All right? Probably averaging about every 3 weeks we were getting certified mail from them. And it's disconcerting when you're being sued for $25,000 a day, and you keep getting the certified mail from the Attorney General's office, and every time you do, say, oh, man. I mean, it gets you talking to yourself, I'll guarantee you. We advanced this religious freedom defense argument, and they went dead silent for 5 months. We didn't hear anything from them for 5 months. And then they came back, and the chief administrative judge, John K. Dietz, chief administrative judge for Travis County, that's the seat of government for Texas, that's where Austin, Texas is, and that's where the seat of government is. He's an important man, and he's a very, very intelligent guy. And he took over the case, and we came back for the first hearing, and he tried to intimidate us initially with threats of having us thrown in the slammer. Implicit. What he did is he ordered his court reporter, said, get security. All right, she called security, and they brought in, security came to the courtroom, and I thought, oh, damn, I'm going to get thrown in the slammer again. I don't want to go back to jail, you know. But in any case, we just sat there. And the judge sat there for a while, and then he just said, okay, you can go. Told security, get out of here. And then he said, I'm going to do something that I've virtually never done before. I'm going to invite you back into chambers and see if we can settle this case privately. And we said, yeah, buddy, let's go. Yeah. Now, the reason that they were willing to settle the case is this. This line of argument is politically explosive because the war on drugs initiated by President Nixon back in 1971 is based on a definition of drugs that presumes the people to be animals. If we eliminate that presumption, if there's a successful challenge where a court has to admit, no, the people aren't animals, if they have to admit that, the war on drugs ends. Do you understand that? And the people who've been convicted under the war on drugs, they may even have cause for some kind of, who knows, compensation out of the government for being falsely convicted as an animal. They can't deal with this issue without at least risking the loss of the war on drugs. The war on drugs laid the foundation for most of the modern police state. If we didn't have the war on drugs, the size of the police departments and their aggressiveness and everything else that we see today, it largely wouldn't be here without the war on drugs. Therefore, if we can show that the people aren't animals, they are men and women made in God's image and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, the police state suffers a terrible loss. It won't disappear, but it will be badly disabled. What are they going to do if they can't chase people that are using drugs? And then the police state laid the foundation for the prison industrial complex, where we jail more people as a percentage of population than any other nation on the face of the earth. That prison industrial complex and all of that concrete and all of that steel and all of that razor wire and all the money it takes to support that thing is all based on a little bitty definition of drugs that presumes the people to be animals in violation of their freedom of religion. There was so much at stake, I don't know that we handled our paperwork correctly. You know, this was... the paperwork I have available on my blog that I make available there and show what we did, it was pretty good. But if I had it to do over again, I'd probably do it a little bit differently. I'd probably and hopefully do it a little bit better. But it was sufficient to cause the Attorney General, they went dead silent for 5 months after we advanced religious freedom defense. Then they spent 5 months trying to negotiate a settlement on this case. I don't mean we sat there every day for 5 months. From the day Judge Dietz took control of the case, after that, we had another hearing, we had another meeting in something like 6 weeks. Then we had another one about 6 weeks after that. And finally, we had a hearing. I think we had a series of three hearings over the period of 5 months. And they finally said, you guys aren't going to settle. We didn't work. And they had agreed that they would drop this case. They would settle the case if the one man that was associated with the case, all he had to do was take a food manufacturer's license. There would be no fines. There would be no penalties. We wouldn't even have to pay the court costs, which were at that point about there'd been no fines, but I guess the court costs, I think they could have wrapped it up to about close to $500,000. There wouldn't have been any fines on top of that. The assistant attorney general that was handling the case, Raul Noriega, he told us at one point, he said, I'd been here for 22 years. He said, I've never heard of an instance, or he said the attorney general sometimes settle cases where they don't impose any fines, but they always impose court costs. He says, I've never heard of a case where they agreed not to impose court costs. They did in our case. And all the other guy had to do, if he would have taken a food manufacturer's license, the whole thing would have been dropped. We didn't agree
They wanted him to trade his right for a privilege.
That's exactly right. They wanted him to agree that he was subject to their jurisdiction. That's what they wanted. And if he'd taken that license, they got him later. They wouldn't have got him then, but they'd be back in 18 months or 2 years, and they would have squashed him like a bug. He wouldn't take the license, and they came back with two more hearings for jurisdiction, whether or not they had jurisdiction in this case. And they declared they did have jurisdiction, And that was in November of 2007, and we haven't heard a word from them since. They still dropped the case. The political implications are massive. They're monstrous. They're incredible. I believe this is the single biggest story to hit the United States in a century, maybe since its beginning. The case, the evidence is there, as fantastic as it sounds. When you apply the fact that the government is declaring the people to be animals and you associate that with the law of genocide, it's clear that the government of the United States is committing genocide against the American people. It's using this genocide, at least as a, I won't say the genocide is precisely the cause, but it at least corresponds to the growth of the police state, to the war on drugs, to the prison industrial complex. All of that is based on a definition. You understand that? I mean, when you look at this, you think, my God, this is all being done with just a couple of words. That's all this is. They inserted one word, the word other. They could have said man or animals. They said man or other animals. And by merely adding that one word, they have changed. They are committing genocide against the American people. They are depriving you of your standing as a man to make claim on those God-given unalienable rights. And they are denying their own obligation to secure those rights. This is a big
story. I want to bring Red in before you have to go. We've only got Al for about 15 more minutes, Red, because he's got a radio show that he goes on at the top of the hour, and we're going to try to get him out of here as close to 10 till the hour as possible, Red. But I want to hear your thoughts on what Al has said so far.
Well, this has been a real treat for me. This is refreshed my memory from what I had learned from Al in the past. And as I'm thinking about it here, I thought, you know, every church, every evangelical church in particular, should have been involved in this case. They should have been backing. Al and the crew as they tackled this thing. But I'd just like to have an idea or hear from Al, did he have any support whatever from any church? I'd like to hear.
Not at the time this was happening, because we weren't really sure. It was one of those things where we sat down and I said, you know, we should have a religious freedom defense on this. And we understood logically that it made sense, but we weren't sure we were right. And it wasn't we weren't broadcasting this at the time that it was being decided. All right, we were not promoting this in a way that people could jump on, but after it's done, and again, the Attorney General had invested 6 years and $500,000 in this case, and they just dropped it because of a couple of pro ses. Do you understand? I don't believe there's a similar story in the United States. I don't believe there's another one like it. That doesn't prove we're right. You understand? In the end, I can't prove that the reason they dropped the case is because of this man or other animals thing. I can't prove that's correct. I can't tell you that absolutely that was the reason, but everything tells me that was the reason. They can't deal with this. It's too explosive.
I can understand that, and I'm so convinced that we're going to see so many things like this happening in the days ahead here, with the political heat that's being generated by the grassroots at the grassroots level, and of course, as you know, I've been really promoting the idea of putting our judges, especially the federal judge and the state judge, but even going down to the traffic court magistrate or whatever, these people all have a conflict of interest. And anybody that's been in the freedom movement for any length of time, they know that the judiciary is our biggest problem. Of the three branches of government that we have, the judges, the judiciary, they are the biggest problem. But when you confront them with the fact that they are government employees, they are beneficiaries of the tax laws, and this makes them an agent of government. And of course, I've been trying to stress the fact that they are servants. They are public servants. And we, the people, are masters, and that's where this sovereignty teaching comes into play. And we can claim this position as a master if we can take the judge and put him in his proper slot, you might say, as just another government agent, and he only has a limited amount of power. He doesn't have the power to make findings of fact or conclusions of law. He can't do it. And, of course, the Seventh Amendment, I have really concentrated on the Seventh Amendment and the fact that the common law jury, Seventh Amendment common law jury, is the highest court in our land, because even the U.S., the nine government agents on the Supreme Court cannot reexamine the findings of a common law jury. And so we're seeing some pretty healthy breakthroughs, and Al has done a beautiful job on this. And anybody that's listening tonight, I'm sure that they are probably going to want to check the archives. And this has been a real treat, and it's a real treat for me, and I'm sure there's a lot of others out there that feel the same thing. So I sure thank you, Al, for making yourself available, because this is the kind of program we like to see. And God bless you as you go your way.
Well, thank you, Red. Let me just remind people one more time where my blog is. It's at adask, A-D-A-S-K, .wordpress.com. Okay? adask.wordpress.com. If you go there and look under the categories section, the very top category on the right-hand side is man or other animals. The earliest, go all the way, scroll down to the bottom of the page. There's two pages of articles there that are listed there. Scroll down to the bottom and then go to the earlier, the oldest page. You will find two of the original documents we wrote on this, on man or other animals, and these are the ones that offer the most insight. It's a powerful idea. You need to understand this, in my opinion. You read it, you make up your own mind and see what you think.
Al, you've got about 10 minutes before you got to roll, really about 8 to 10 minutes before, if you want to get out of here by 10 till. So we got just a few minutes here. Jan, our friend Jan from Montana, has put a couple of comments on the chat that I think are worthy of bringing to your attention. And one is, she says, is that why one czar is trying to declare animals have rights?
Yeah, it's at least it corresponds. When they are saying that animals have the same rights as we do, they're essentially saying we have the same rights as animals. Right? Insofar as they're trying to make that point, this is not inconsistent with the man or other animals theme. And the most important point about this is that this is not just politics. This is spiritual warfare that's been going on for several thousand years. You can trace it ultimately all the way back to Genesis in the Bible. Are you a man or woman made in God's image and endowed by your Creator with certain unalienable rights? Again, made in God's image we find in the Bible, the unalienable rights we find in the Declaration of Independence. If that's who you are, the government is your servant.
And we need to remember that the Declaration of Independence, the Declaration of Independence is higher law than even the Constitution.
Well, it's co-equal with it, at least. I don't know if you're familiar. Have you heard the term the organic law of the United States of America?
Yes.
Do you know what it is?
Well, I'm gonna.
Here's what's declared
like
by Congress in the revised statutes of 1875 and 1873. Right after the table of contents, Congress has a section in the revised statutes that is the cover page is the organic law of the United States of America. And afterwards, they present four documents. And the first document is the Declaration of Independence. The next document is the Articles of Confederation. That's Year of Our Lord, 1781. Then they have the Northwest Territorial Ordinance, Year of Our Lord, 1787. And finally, the Constitution of the United States, which was ratified by the people and first ratified in 1788. I can't recall. But in any case, we got the Declaration of Independence, Articles of Confederation, Northwest Territorial Ordinance, and the Constitution of the United States. And the Congress declares them, writes them out and declares them to be the organic law of the United States of America. At no point do they suggest that the Constitution has suspended the previous three documents. This declaration by Congress is 1875, 1873, and 1875. This is after the Civil War. They're saying those four documents, and nothing in there suggests that any of those documents have been suspended. The Declaration of Independence is at least as much the law today as the Constitution of the United States. Plus, it can't be amended. Right?
And that's inclusive of the Bill of Rights, correct?
Sure. Has it been amended? I mean, the Constitution has been amended, but it can't be technically, given that the Declaration of Independence cannot be amended. An argument can be made that you can't amend the Constitution in a way that's contrary to the original Declaration of Independence. That was the first cornerstone on which this country was built, and it is still the law. It's not just an historical document. It is as much the law today as the Constitution. And it's also, it embodies profound spiritual principles, the idea that we are each endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, unprecedented. Throughout Western history, we've had kings, monarchies. The reason a man was a king, a sovereign in a particular country, is because he and he alone received his rights directly from God. He had the divine right of kings. He became king in a church ceremony. He wasn't elected. He wasn't appointed. It wasn't a civil process. He went to a church, and they put a crown on his head in a coronation ceremony. And that crown was intended to represent the corona that you see around the heads of the saints and the Christ in medieval paintings. He was God's one man in the kingdom, and all else were subjects because they did not get their rights directly from God. When our country started out and they said, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men, not just kings, all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, they elevated all men to the status of kings. This is the foundation for sovereignty in this country. This is why the Supreme Court of the United States declared in Chisholm versus Georgia in Year of Our Lord, 1793, they said, this nation, the people of this nation, are sovereigns without subjects. Why? Because we all had essentially, when they say the unalienable rights, they're talking about the divine right of kings. We all got an equal dose of rights directly from God. Prior to this, it was presumed only the king in the monarchies had those divine rights.
Al, we've got another caller from Colorado, and we've only got about 4 minutes before Al has to run. Colorado, you're on live. Area code 303, you have a hand up.
Well, hey, Gary, this is Gary.
Hey, Gary.
How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Hey, Al, real quick, I know we got three minutes. We got limited time, Al. Very nice job. I watched the whole 60 minutes. I don't want your audience to forget that the entire 60 minutes was a hit piece. If you'll recall, they opened up with how great our defense secretary was. They made him out to just be the prince of the world. And then the second piece was all to demonize Pakistan to butter us up for the new war because they've been hiding bin Laden this entire time. And then the third segment was obviously to demonize us. But Al, as I was waiting for the peace to happen, and I knew it was going to be a hit piece, I'd been warned about it, and so I didn't know if it was going to be the first segment or whatever it was going to be. I knew at some point that sovereignty was going to have a spokesman. I mean, having watched 60 Minutes enough, I knew they were going to put some poor bastard in front of that camera. You know what I mean? To represent all of us. And I must say, sir, you did a hell of a job. Even though they tried to clip you, even though, you know, they tried to trick you, and I know that after 2 hours they just picked out what they wanted, you looked straight at the camera, your voice was very strong. You know, you mean you really represented well, even within the middle of that hit piece.
Well, I appreciate the compliment. I can tell you it was an interesting moment altogether. And I came out of there hugely empowered. I went toe-to-toe with 60 Minutes, you understand? And they aren't that good. I guarantee it's going to be hard to intimidate me in another confrontation, another interview, another confrontation. I handled those people under the circumstances. I handled them as well as it could be done. And I'm not saying that to break my arm complimenting myself. I'm just saying I know I can handle these people now. I didn't know that before, but I can.
Yeah.
But you can leave us alive.
You did a good job. Hey, Terry, Red, thank you, guys. Thank you.
Well, Gary, hang in here with us because we're going to have to let Al go. And Al, I want to say thank you very, very much. And like Red, this has been a very special show for me. And I know that I'm going to even go back and listen to it again myself because I believe that there's a lot that we've talked about that everyone needs to absorb. And Gary's one of those people. That's why I particularly made sure he was aware you were going to be on tonight because, you know, he'll be using this in a defense of clients. So it will be applied. And I think that there's been some great lessons learned tonight and more to be had from it. So, Al, I'm going to let you go. And just thanks again. And we definitely want to have you back here because there's a lot more to talk about. I think we just scratched the surface tonight. Red, any last comment for Al?
No, I'm just real pleased that we had this kind of a quality program. And I'm real thrilled with this. So you won't find a more articulate guest than what we've had tonight. And so our audience, they ought to be they ought to feel like they've really been fed spiritually and all tonight with what has been said, and I know I have, and so I hope a lot of others have felt the same way.
Al, any final word?
I'm just very grateful to be here. I appreciate the time and opportunity. I'm glad you folks. I get going and I can talk a long time, as you can see. I'm glad to have people put up with it sometimes. So, thanks very much for having me. Look forward to seeing you another time.
Thank you very much, Al, and good night.
Mm-hmm. God bless. Good night.
Hey, Gary?
Yeah?
Gary, you still on with us?
I think so.
How long were you able to hear Al?
The whole show.
Well, what do you think? Do you see any defenses that could be raised as a direct result of what he's saying?
While he was talking, I was Google searching the term, and upon Google searching the term, it does come up repeatedly. I haven't had an opportunity to check Colorado's statute, but I wouldn't be surprised. And like he said, you could think of the drug which affects an animal, like a horse or something, but that term or other animal does put it in context with regard to really who the target of drug offenses are. You know, not, and that's not a racial comment. I'm just speaking about typically, you know, when you prosecute someone for drugs, it's a victimless crime, you know. And in that sense, you're being treated like a ward of the state, when in the end, not only is there no victim, there's just no one really complaining. I mean, who's the complaining party at all? Other than, you know, when you rob someone's house, you have to go to prison for robbery, not methamphetamine. So certainly drugs lead to crime and drugs are bad. But in the end, there's no victim. So the only way to get around it is to make you a ward of the state, to make you less than a man. So I've always liked the conscientious dissenter argument. I've always liked that. So I'll really be interested in looking at that. in the future. But on the other hand, in terms of the right client, it would have to be someone who understood it and wanted me to make that argument because they understood it. So it probably wouldn't work for your average client.
Red, we got about 5 minutes. Any final comments from you?
Well, you know, how much of this drug problem that we have in this country has been brought about because of frustration and anger and hopelessness that is so much a part of the everyday life of you know, the American people. They're looking. They go to the drugs for an escape from the nightmare that they're living. And you see, I think that Al has done a great service here, and I think that if we could get some of our ministers in our pulpits and such in this country that would get a good handle on this and start preaching it from their pulpits and teaching their people. I don't think you would have people in the drug game out there, you know, killing themselves off with these drugs if they had some answers to their frustrations and the hopelessness that confront the people today on such a massive scale. I've always felt that the drug situation was a direct result of hopelessness and frustration and you know, a sense of futility, so that the people go to the drugs so that they can live with themselves, so that they can sleep. The alcoholic, they get into that trap because of the frustration with life and the way things are happening. So maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
Gary, what other thoughts you got? We've got a couple minutes left.
I'm sorry, what's that again?
Did you have any other thoughts related to what Al has talked about tonight?
No, I just enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. It was a good talk.
Do you find it interesting? It reminds me of what Red has been going through for many years, in that he brought up something that was they really did not want to have entered into evidence into the court regarding the certified documents proving that the 16th Amendment and the 17th, for that matter, were not ever properly ratified. And he brought up this issue of the other animals, and in both cases, the cases have tended to either go away, be dismissed, drop through the cracks, anything they can do to prevent that evidence from coming forth and being entered into the record.
Well, after all of what Al said, I still like Red's comments the best, that in the end, it's the judges. And I, quite frankly, other than what Mr. Fine is doing in California, I don't know the answer to that problem, because it's all about the judges being the gatekeepers of information that is so objectively real it can't be denied.
And the judges know that they're being tax beneficiaries. It comes on the line if they allow that to come forward.
Well, I mean, the whole mortgage crisis is based upon, you know, the judge's unwillingness to go against the bank and always rule against the people, because, you know, the mortgage-backed securities are tied to his or her pension. So there's always, when you give a judge a retirement plan, there's always a conflict of interest. I don't know how you get around it.
Red,
you got to support the system. You got to support. So, well, guys, thank you. I'm gonna sign off now.
Thanks, Gary. Red, we only got about 30 seconds.
I don't know what I can say that would add value to what has already been said.
Well, thank you, Red. And I appreciate you getting Al to be on the show tonight. And that was a great blessing. I appreciate you, brother. Good night, everyone. This has been Walls in Our Minds.
Yeah, good night.
Get out.